forces of the gathering authoritarian storm in our country are evident in many ways. It is manifesting itself in powerful and continuing nationalism, in disdain for human rights, in the entwinement of government and religion, in a controlled mass media, in the protection of corporate power and the suppression of labor power, and in the encouragement of violence. The power of labor has been channeled into the Democratic and Republican parties, the twin parties of capitalism. We need a workers' party, but we don't even have the nucleus of one. Race and gender are formative in the building of authoritarian regimes. We see this in the USA. Haitians who are black have been accused of eating cats and dogs. Women's rights to control their own bodies is under attack from the Supreme Court on down, and women are marked as childless cat ladies and told to stay home and bear children. We speak today with Diane Feeley on race and gender as formative in building authoritarian regimes and the potential power of our labor movement long buried in the clutches of the Democratic and Republican parties. Diane Feeley is an editor of the magazine Against the Current. She's a leader of Solidarity, a socialist feminist organization. Diane lives in Detroit, where she's been an activist for many years in the United Automobile Workers Union. Diane Feeley, a hearty welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks.
Diane, Chris Hedges, our previous guest, who inaugurated our series on fascism, what it is and how to fight it, is of the opinion that labor has to be central to protecting ourselves and to fight back. Why is this so?
Well, I agree with Chris on this. First of all, the membership of a union is diverse. And since we live in a highly segregated society in terms of where we live, the kinds of schools we go to, it's really the most diverse place we will be in. And we're there for quite a while every week. Not only is it a diverse place where people of all opinions, of various races and ethnicities and genders all work. And what is our job? What is the idea of a union? A union is not an insurance company. It's a membership organization. And therefore, it's about what we want in terms of our wages, our working conditions, our benefits. So we're concerned about the quality of our life, the security of our life, not only at our workplace, but also in our communities. So it's a very social place to be. And it's also a very democratic or potentially democratic place where we have to listen to each other, where we get to debate and discuss and decide what our priorities are. So all of this really teaches us solidarity, not only with who are our co-workers, but other people, because we can't just be concerned about our own selves. We live in this larger world. So that sense of solidarity, that sense that we are all human, operates against the idea of fascism where only some are humans and others are subhumans. So it's really a very important institution in our society to really develop ourselves as human beings. So the potential of democracy through the unions, of course, can have a big impact not only on our jobs and our communities, but in a broader sense in our world and how we organize ourselves.
Diane, historically, the trade union movement in the United States has taken the pragmatic position of rewarding your friends and punishing your enemies. Sometimes they've supported the Democrats, therefore, and sometimes the Republicans. But what has been the result, do you think, of this pragmatism? I mean, after all, the wages of workers in America have not gone up in real terms for, 50 years? And now we see a growing fascist movement, which is enjoying historic support among many sections of the working class. So how do you assess the consequences of this traditional union pragmatism?
I think it shows how so much of what we've learned in school and in our society and even in some unions is actually wrong and not helpful to us. We are taught that, I remember in grammar school learning that if you didn't like the situation in your country, you voted out the party that was in power for the other party. That is, it was a two-party system. And also a great focus on the individual candidate rather than on the structure. What's the structure of our society and how can we make that structure better meet our needs? So in terms of the unions, I think a lot of the concessions were sold on the basis that they were absolutely necessary for our jobs. I mean, I retired as an auto worker, and I had the opportunity of debating this issue. Would it save our jobs if we accepted two-tier wages? And my argument and my organizing was, no, it did not. That in fact, it would just bring more concessions. But this is what we're told, that the concessions are necessary because the auto, in this case, it was the auto industry, is going through restructuring, outsourcing, or automation, and that we just had to bite the bullet until times became better. But of course, they never became better because we accepted the concessions. And so we have to break out of this mold and seek a different way. And I think that's something that the UAW is trying to do now through our stand-up strike strategy that we used. So we have to develop a different perspective about how we fight for ourselves. And that includes, in my opinion, breaking with the two-party system because it does not represent our needs, as you can see in the platform of both of the parties.
Diane Feely, what's going on in the Teamsters Union? It's one of the most powerful unions in the country. The president of the Teamsters Union, Sean O'Brien, addressed the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. He spoke admiringly of Trump, calling him a tough son of a bitch. He got wild applause. The union then took a neutral position in the upcoming election, but a majority of the members of his union say they support Trump, and Trump wants to get rid of unions. How do you explain all of this?
Well, first of all, I don't think a majority of the membership of the union does support Trump, although I think probably a good portion, maybe a third or even a little bit more, supports Trump because they see him as an alternative to the neoliberal policies that have existed, that both Democrats and Republicans have carried out. It's really sad when some people who see this racist, hierarchical guy as some kind of an alternative. But I think that's really what they see. Many of them say, well, I may not agree with him on reproductive rights. I may not agree with him about this, that, or the other thing. But when he was in power, the economy was in better shape. As if the economy has very much to do with who's president of the United States in a capitalist society. So I think it just shows how badly educated we are. And I must say, there are sections of the Teamsters who have broken with the idea that Trump represents an alternative. I think the Black Caucus has a different position. I think there are other regional and local Teamsters who have different positions. Unfortunately, there really isn't the kind of alternative there should be, where there's another alternative to neoliberalism or the kind of neo-fascism that Trump represents on the ballot in all 50 states. Because, of course, the two-party system likes to perpetuate itself. And so that's the horrible situation that we're in.
You know, there's been a stirring of sorts, certainly in the labor movement. Currently, unionized workers in this country, including public sector workers, only about 11%, whereas once upon a time it was at least a third. But there's been a stirring in the movement. Amazon workers have voted to support a union. Railroad workers wanted to strike, but, well, they were prevented from doing so by the Democratic Party Biden administration. the teachers' unions in the last year, especially in West Virginia, Chicago, they've been militant. You believe that what we need is a workers' party. Currently, we barely have the nucleus of one. So, Diane, how do we get from where we are to where we have indeed a workers' party, and what might be the role of unions like those I just mentioned?
This is the big dilemma, because there are so many problems that prevent parties from emerging, whether we begin with the tremendous money that's involved and the kind of legislation that allows enormous amounts of money to prevent anything else. I see that the Green Party, even when it's been able to get all the petitions to get on the ballot, is being challenged by the Democratic Party, which just shows how undemocratic the Democratic Party is. So there are certainly all of these barriers that exist. Yet at the same time, it seems to me there's more of a sense that the two-party system is not in our interests. And therefore, kind of looking around, well, what can we do? How can we move ahead? And yet we see that the top leaders in the major unions are very wedded to the Democratic Party. So I actually think that we were set back 30 years ago when under Tony Mazzocchi, there were attempts to start a labor party, and actually 11 unions signed on, but they were afraid to move to that next step of actually beginning to run candidates. So that was a setback for us. Well, how can we move forward now where there's a greater sense that we need a party that represents us? It seems to me we've got to begin small at the local level. I know in Detroit, many of the local offices are nonpartisan offices. So I think it would be a good idea if we began to run for those nonpartisan offices, get the experience, and begin to network so that we could do this. Now, actually, the Green Party, for example, I think has something like 150 people in office, all at very local levels. So it's possible that we could begin to do this and build a much stronger network, particularly based on a union here or a union there that would be willing to begin that process. So it's a difficult struggle. And I don't have a solution at the state or national level, but I think with developing that experience at the local level, that may give us the self-confidence to move ahead.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my longtime friend and colleague, Attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Diane Feeley. Diane, some years ago, the great economist and socialist leader Ernest Mandel observed that, and this is what he said, we're at the foot of the Himalayas without adequate tools, but we have to climb up. Would that be your assessment now?
I think so. I met Ernest Mandel a few times, and he would always ask me about the U.S. labor movement. And I would always say to him, well, we're down, but we're continuing to go down. So maybe at some point we'll be able to start moving up. So, yes, I think that we have a long way to go, but we have such a great need to begin moving that I think we just have to start.
Diane, please talk about how Trump is using both race and gender in building his support, and how historically fascism used race and gender as well.
Yes, this is a very interesting question to see how race and gender are the building blocks for fascism. And it's amazing to see Trump and Vance present a kind of masculist line. I tried to avoid the debates, but at one point I turned on actually the Canadian news hoping that they wouldn't be showing the debate. And what they had was a man on there tearing his shirt off. And it turned out this was a wrestler who was speaking at the Republican Party convention. I thought this was the perfect example of a masculinist symbol. And I think everything that they say and do reinforces that they are strong and therefore they can lead. So we have Vance who talks about the cat ladies. We have Trump and Vance talking about how Haitians eat cats and dogs. So what is this all about? It's all about dehumanizing people, their attack on trans people. All of this is to say there's two categories of people, the humans, which are us, and the subhumans. And who are the subhumans? Well, they're all the immigrants who, of course, are illegal under their definition. They're the women who really belong at home and in the house. They're the trans people, and they don't have equal rights. In fact, Vance even says it's only parents who should have extra votes, and presumably it's people who choose or are unable to have children who should have lesser rights. So this whole way of their conducting their campaign, I think, indicates the racial and gendered categories that they use. And this is something that is common, I think, to every fascist regime. If we look at the Italian government, and I think under Mussolini, it's different than under Hitler, but it's similar in terms of choosing which categories to see as human and which not to see as human. And interestingly enough, in all of these cases, the home is seen as this romantic place in which the woman is the, I guess, the queen of the home. She doesn't have any rights, but she's there as a sort of sacrificial figure. So all of this, I would say, in terms of Italy, it was the nation, the strength of the nation. In Germany, it was different. It was the strength of the master race, because even Germans who were disabled, had mental problems, were Jewish, were Black, were not considered humans. So it's only the master race that can construct the nation. So all of this is pretty sick stuff. But I think it's really about the insecurity that people have in a society that is very insecure. And certainly we're facing an economic crisis now. And that was similar to the economic crisis that was happening after World War I. And certainly that had a big impact on both Germany and Italy, as well as other countries as well. And we're seeing that same kind of authoritarianism arise now as there is this economic crisis as we go into a late stage of capitalism. In fact, I call it geriatric capitalism because it's certainly at the end of its life, and yet there is no new birth that's coming into being, and that's what's creating this frustration.
Diane Feely, let's talk about Project 2025. How do you see this as helping the forces of fascism in the USA?
Well, to me, it's like it's their wish list. They have a wish list. They put forward all the things that they would like to do, not that they would be capable of doing them. And of course, I ask, well, where is our wish list? Because our wish list would be quite different from theirs. So if we look at some of the elements, we say, okay, they want to, quote, restore the family. That doesn't mean providing parental care, reducing work hours, developing a free public education that's of quality. No, it's stopping sexual orientation. It's saying that all federal laws and regulations should be stripped of any discussion of sexual orientation, gender equality, reproductive rights, saying, okay, for the Department of Health and Human Services, there should be a definition of marriage and the family, which should be biblically based. Biblically based. Well, that's quite a narrow view. That federal agencies should be stripped of their regulatory capacity, and that all of this should be basically placed under the office of the presidency. So without all of the regulatory agencies and the regulatory power, what do we have left? We've lost, 75 years of regulations that are very important, whether we're talking about health and safety laws, whether we're talking about minimum wages, it's all gone. Whether we talk about the environment, it's very interesting that Trump and Vance speak a lot about the fears. They appeal to the fears of insecurity that people have. But that's usually related to the border or crime, even though crime is going down. But it's never related to the climate, which is our most severe problem. How can we live in the world without destroying our environment? Those are the things that we need regulations for. And yet that's something that's not at all considered. Now, if we take a look at what their plan, what Project 2025 plan is for the unions, they'd like to strip the unions of basically any power that we have, so that the National Labor Relations Board, which is one of the few agencies that's set up to be of help to unions, that can help organize elections to find out whether the workers at a place want a union, that would be minimized. I think Trump has said on the first day he was in office, he would fire the main person in charge, the general counsel of the NLRB, because she's too progressive. It would eliminate many of the rules that currently exist. And what it would do, and I think this is really important, is it would allow the employer to set up basically its own phony unions. And so this really takes us back really 100 years in terms of the kinds of labor legislation that we've had. Now, I think most people haven't taken a look at Project 2025. After all, it's a huge project. And as I say, it's a wish list. So even if Trump and Vance were elected, it doesn't mean it would come into being. It would be certainly, it would seem to me, that there would be many, many demonstrations and meetings and challenges, legal and on the street, to oppose that kind of wish list. But it just shows what their plan is for us and how we have to develop an alternative that's based on securing people's rights and living in a society that is a communal society and not one where everybody feels like they're in line and they better beat the other person because there's only going to be so much food or housing or jobs to go around. No, that's not, that can't be our vision. Our vision must be one of solidarity, not just for our own family, but for the larger community and the larger environment in which we live.
Diane Feeley, we are sadly just about out of time, but tell us about the organization, one of them to which you belong, Solidarity, and about the publication, Against the Current, which you help edit.
Thank you very much for mentioning that. So people can go to the website Against the Current and see our current and back issues and get a subscription if they'd like. They can go to the Solidarity-US website and look at the articles and ideas there. And we're actually running a series of classes on fascism, taking a look at history and today. And people can register for that. So Thanks very much for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us today, really, Diane Feeley. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane. It's been terrific talking to you.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. First up is a clip from MSNBC.
And now, for a moment of clarity.
Why can't the Democrats pick one or two nominees that truly jeopardize the country? Maybe it's Hegseth, maybe it's Gabbard, maybe it's Patel. Why can't they get together and draw a line somewhere and at least slow down what they've described for 9 years as a slow roll toward autocracy?
Nicole, I'm like boiling inside listening to you describe the reality of this political moment, because that's what it is. The thing that I find so stunning is that Democrats have never realized that this is a political moment. They think that somehow we're still playing the 1980s, you know, Ronald Reagan and a Tip O'Neill kind of kumbaya moment. Yeah, we skirmish here and there, but in the end, we're going to have a little toast with some bourbon or some good whiskey and call it even. No, that's not what this is. Christy's exactly right. I don't understand what the DOJ is going to be arguing. You will never see what Jack Smith wrote in second volume. You will never hear it. You will never see it. Why? Because it all goes away on January 20th. You know, you've got the Senate. Yes, the number, even 56 senators being Republican, you know, you got at least two or three that you can work with and move the needle to sort of get some things done, number one. Number two, use the system. You know the rules. I mean, you watch Mitch McConnell slap you around every time he's been majority leader. Just without hesitation, just go and say, no, we're not doing that. Oh, you want that appointee? Guess what? Not getting it. Right? We're going to hold it up. We're going to make you pay a political price for it. And yet we're sitting here. I mean, again, I very much respect Akeem Jeffries, very much excited about his leadership, but you do not hand over the gavel and say, oh yeah, we're putting down our swords and picking up our bipartisan plowshares. They're going to shove those plowshares up your behind. That's the goal here. That's the politics. These Republicans are not designed to work with you. They have spent a generation plotting for this moment. They've spent a generation trying to upend the work that a lot of us worked very hard to put in place to try to govern. It's why we never came up to a repeal and replace solution. All we could do was the slogan, because it was enough to move the political needle the way where we wanted it to move. Then the policy requirement that you actually do something, whatever. Oh, infrastructure every day for 4 years? That wasn't the goal. It was the narrative. It was the politics of making everyone else jump through hoops. So I don't know what to tell you. Next, I don't know what the Democrats are going to do, because they don't know what they're going to do. I mean, Adam Schiff, you know, seriously, that's your response? Well, I really don't think we should, you know, expose the system in any way that could, be detrimental to the system. You know the guys on the other side want to blow the system up, and you're worried about your actions being detrimental? That's not how you protect the system. So I don't know, Nicole. These guys, I've never seen anything like it. a political operation that is oxymoronic in its term, because they're not an operation and they're not political. I don't get it.
The Sixth Sense is one of my favorite movies, and it's encapsulated our politics for so long. You know, the norms are dead, and you've got one party that's proud of it, and that is in and of itself norm-busting on the right, but you've got the other party that still doesn't know it, and that is, in some moments, also a threat.
And that you just summed up the 2024 election, and how voters feel at that moment then, and how a lot of us are going to feel going forward. The reality is in front of you. Just see it for what it is. And to Christie's point, if you have tools to confront that reality, use them. It's okay. The norms have been reduced to rubble in many cases. Look at our judicial system and how it was manipulated and delayed and used against itself to keep Donald Trump from being held accountable. In the face of a Supreme Court that has given him absolute power, the only tool you have left is your ingenuity and your political gumption. And if you lack either one of those, and in this case, I think the Democrats lack both, that's why Pam Bondi can sit there in that hearing and absolutely ignore and refuse to answer and just pretend. And there was no outcry. There was no calling out her behavior. The same with what we saw in the other hearing with, what's his name? I'm blanking right now, for Attorney General Hegseth. So the reality of it is these guys know how to come at the game because they know there's not going to be the pushback. And that's the problem.
Do you still think that maybe Tulsi Gabbard or RFK Jr. might have some problems?
Oh, they have problems, but the Republicans don't care about their problems. Just like they don't care about the fact that Kristi Noem isn't qualified to be in the role they're putting her up for, nor is Pete Hegseth. But they will bow and say yes and pass their nomination. She will not control the immigration policy of this country. She has the title. And this is typical in Trump world for women. You have the title, but I don't know how much power you're really going to have. Because Holman is the one who's going to call the shots. Donald Trump specifically selected him for a purpose. And Stephen Miller is a part of that purpose as well. And so they're going to drive this immigration policy, this deportation policy. And so, you know, Senator Kim was exactly right to ask the question to get it on the record. And she could not answer it in a way that would not displease Donald Trump, because we know what's going on there. With respect to Hegseth and the others, look, the bottom line is the things about him, the allegations of his lewd behavior, his drunkenness, all of that didn't matter, because that's not germane to what they need him there for. And so this is going to be the setup for what is going to come on the back end with the more controversial picks. And I think you'll just see Republicans kind of, you know, backslide away from, you know, really addressing the problem in front of them, because they don't want to be on the wrong side of Donald Trump. And therefore, they will nod and patch, just as we saw with Hegseth. Every time the Democrats level up the charge, they will submit into the record a prepackaged response with a letter or some article that, you know, confirms that individual to be of right character and mind.
Catch Michael Steele on The Weekend, Saturdays and Sundays, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on MSNBC.
Next up, we have Karen Hunter.
Karen Hunter.
Joe Biden gave a farewell speech, something that every president does not do, matter of fact. You know, the last time T. Rump was in, he did not do it. Matter of fact, he led an insurrection instead of bidding farewell. Instead of being a gracious leader, he led a group of people to the Capitol for destruction and division. Joe Biden last night, and I was thinking as he was giving this speech, where are all of the comments about his dementia? I mean, it was fever pitch, the media around the clock. To the man had to step down. You couldn't stop talking about how old, and yes, that debate was painful, but you know what else is painful? the next 4 years, about to be real painful. You know what was painful? The 4 years previously, kind of painful. Here we are, you know, and while I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time lamenting something that Tyler Merritt writes about in his book, This Changes Everything, I do want us to sit in our own process. And today, and Karen Hunter's Awesome, the podcast, I brought back a podcast that I did like 4 or 5 years ago, where I looked at Trump versus Xi Jinping, the leader of China, and the differences between these two men. But also, you know, we're going to be hearing a lot about China, a lot of TikTok and Red Page or whatever. It's like some stuff is happening in our social media spaces. But also, I think globally, there's a lot going on with Israel. And I mean, it's just there's a whole geopolitical swirl that could probably make our heads spin. But I want us to focus on us. There was some comments last night, you know, about Biden. There's a picture that was going around of Jill. So off to the side, and Joe Biden references this, and we'll play a couple of clips from that, that his family's everything. And then he talks about Kamala Harris and Doug being family. And they were all sitting off to the side. And there's a picture of them. It's Doug Imhoff sitting next to Kamala Harris. And then sitting next to Kamala Harris is Jill Biden. And Jill and Doug are holding hands in Kamala Harris's lap. And people are like, that's so weird. That's so weird. And I was like, I don't know the trauma bond that these folk must have, because not only did they go through a presidency that they had to pick up the pieces from a whole insurrectionist and try to put the country back together, try to bring some semblance of unity and American, you know, e pluribus unum to this country after a sitting president led an insurrection, called for the killing of his vice president, stormed the Capitol and sat and laughed while he ate McDonald's and drank Coca-Cola, saying that on purpose. But they came in with the thought that, oh, we can repair this. Student loan debt forgiveness, a whole host of bills and plans to protect everything from Affordable Care Act to lowering the cost of insulin to making sure that people had resources when there were tragedies, making sure people, FEMA showed up and all this, like just being there. So last night when Biden said goodbye, I felt some ways about it, because I'm like, man. And then to see people like not understand humanity. And then I was wondering, is that where we are? I'm not giving ground to it personally. I'm actually doubling down on humanity. I'm doubling down on zero tolerance to inhumanity. I'm doubling down on those things, because it's only the people standing in the gap that will make the difference. So we have to stand up and stand in the gap and say, no, 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 that doesn't represent me. I like that they were holding hands in her lap, because it said that they felt something. Don't you want to feel something? Don't you want to be a human being and say, hey, we are about to go into uncharted waters here. I am concerned. It's sad to watch Joe Biden have to give that speech, have to talk about what's coming. And if history is any barometer of what's next, damn, it's about to get real chilly for a lot of us. Real chilly. A lot of people are going to find out. And I don't want them to. There's no glee. I'm not sitting around happy about it. But even that, there are people still nasty and mad. You won. Why are you being so evil? Oh, that's your default. That's your due north? That's who you are? Okay. Nothing we can do about that. But there is something we can do about this, about us. So doesn't happen frequently. But I think it was necessary. And I think the things that Joe Biden said were both poignant and cautionary. Let me say it like that. Let's play the first speech part.
I want to warn the country of some things that give me great concern. This is a dangerous concentration, and that's a dangerous concentration of power in the hands of a very few ultra-wealthy people. The dangerous consequences if their abuse of power is left unchecked. Today, an oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence. That literally threatens our entire democracy, our basic rights and freedoms, and a fair shot for everyone to get ahead. We see the consequences all across America. And we've seen it before. More than a century ago, the American people stood up to the robber barons back then and busted the trust. They didn't punish the wealthy. Just made the wealthy pay play by the rules everybody else had to. Workers want rights to earn their fair share. You know, they were dealt into the deal and helped put us on a path to building the largest middle class, the most prosperous century any nation in the world has ever seen.
I often think about these robber barons because even before he started, when he was talking about the oligarchs, I was like, oh, we've been here before. Or maybe we never left. I mean, this nation was founded by robber barons, right? These framers of the constitutions, those men that signed the Constitution and crafted the Constitution, they were all wealthy landowners, all of them. Washington's wife owned 300 human beings. That was extreme wealth. Thomas Jefferson, extreme wealth. Ben Franklin, extreme wealth. They crafted a world that would protect the wealthy. So why would this be any different? Except now the extremity, the levels of wealth. I mean, Elon Musk is on paper the wealthiest man in the world. He has enough money to give each person in the United States of America $100 million. He has enough money to do that. Just about, right? He can give at least all of us $10 million and not miss a beat. Instead, he's using his wealth to create division. Instead, he's using his wealth to create more wealth. Instead, he's using his wealth as a billy club to beat people over the head and to be a bully as he fee-fi-fo on folks left and right. It is ugly what is happening right now, and Joe Biden is absolutely correct. And we've been here before. The thing that really stopped those robber barons was the Great Depression. So it wasn't that the Americans rose up. No, they do what they're doing now. Because everybody, I think, imagines themselves as one of these wealthy people. So you idolize them and you put them on pedestals. Not you, not me, but the country. And on the other side, of that, and Smith, I don't see this clip on here. People in California are actually coming together. After the first wave of just terrible journalism, people saying all kinds of things, folk are just coming together and supporting each other to the point that the folk, like the goodwill people, they don't have room for all of the stuff. We played a clip from Jennifer Lewis. She had to come back home with her stuff because there was no more room for the stuff. People are just showing up. They're feeding people. Folk that have restaurants are feeding the people that are helping the people. It is very community. As much as people want to talk about Hollywood and these rich elite, no, the rich elite are the Elon Musk and the Zuckerbergs and the Bill Gates and the Jeff Bezos and the Donald Trump, who is not really in their club. He was Fugazi, but they used him as a Manchurian candidate. And he's doing Peter Thiel's and those folk. Yeah, he's doing their bidding. And here we are. But we know what it is now, and we can read. We can read and organize in a way that maybe our forefathers couldn't. We could do better even than they did because we have more resources now. So we're going to do more. But I'm pleased, everybody that I've been checking in with in Los Angeles, and I know folk are still on pins and needles because they don't know which way the wind is going to blow, literally. But the firefighters that came in from Canada and that came in from Mexico that are putting that pink stuff down everywhere, the fire retardant stuff and fighting ahead of the fire and making sure that people's whatever's left is going to be preserved. All of that is happening in a time when you're not really sure who your neighbor is. Well, Altadena, they're coming together, too, even though pretty much people have lost everything. So I'm encouraged. At the same time, I was thinking about whether I should be concerned. You know, I know there was some foreboding when the election night happened. I was like, ugh. And then I sat with that and I said, my grandparents had a much harder time than I will ever have. And I know my great-grandparents, who I only knew one of them, my father's grandmother, their time was tough and rough. They lived in a country with no set-asides, no handouts. They had to lean in on community. As I mentioned yesterday, so many stories that I've heard of families broken up. When you read about, you know, some of these celebrities from that period of time, from the 40s and 30s, you know, they may have had siblings and some were sent down south. Some was, you know, people figured out how to take care of each other, even if it meant breaking up families to literally make sure that the kids ate and had a roof over their heads. If an auntie didn't have a child, we sent a child to her house. And we may be back at those places without the 40, 50, or forever, because those people understood the assignment. We have gotten into a place where we look at each other not as family, which is why, you know, I'm so proud of the Nubian space. I'm so proud of Urban View, because in many ways, it was with intention that I came in to create family, and we're here. Remember, it was a fight for me. If some of you don't remember those early days, but even the notion that this channel should be cohesive in the sense that, you know, not in terms of ideals, but in terms of feel, like we should be able to hand off the mic to the next person, We should be able to support whatever anyone is doing on this channel. And we have. And you have. So I just want to say thank you, too, for buying into it, because you're here with that. You know, we're going to continue, at least on this channel today, we're going to talk with a lawmaker, a state rep. Some of you need to run for your local offices, for your representatives locally. Everybody lives somewhere. Not everyone should go to Congress. Some of you need to run right where you are, because you can and you can win. I know in my community, I think the person, you know, we got to pick, I think there were three open seats. And I think the vote count at the end, because I looked, was like 1,200 votes. I'm like, that's winnable. Some of you don't even know. That's winnable. You can win a seat with 1,200 votes. You can get 1,200 votes, especially if you have done what Tiffany has done in her community in Newark. Invite people in, know your neighbors, so it's not such a shock when you show up. You know, as many, she talked about Roz Baraka, who's from Newark. A lot of, you know, Cory Booker's in Congress right now. He's a senator, sitting senator, one of the five black senators that we have in our Congress. And, you know, for many people, he didn't win the first time he ran for mayor of Newark, even though he moved into one of these tenement buildings. And I think he rescued a dog and was out in the streets. You could see him out in the streets, but he wasn't from there. It was a stepping stone. It was always a stepping stone. And I'm going to say this with my full chest, because I covered his first run when he lost. I spent a lot of time with him. And I'm not saying he wasn't earnestly caring about the people of Newark, but it was an absolute stepping stone. It wasn't about building there. Sharp James is from there. There's still vestiges, and we could talk about Sharp James and corruption. We could talk about Stacey Abrams today, because we should have these conversations, because it makes it difficult to support when there are these things that you also have to defend. Marion Barry, you know, but I'd rather defend somebody that is fighting for me, even if they've done some things that, yeah, I'm like, come on, ma'am, sir, what are you doing? But at least there's, you know, I became a lifeguard in a pool that Sharp James envisioned for kids from the hood to swim. It is one of the most beautiful JFK swimming facilities in the summertime. The whole roof retracts. It is amazing. In the winter, they give lessons, and the lifeguards that come out of there get to make $10, $11, $12 an hour. These kids, so beautiful, the lifeguard instructors. You know, it was just a nice environment. I never felt afraid going there, and I would be there at night learning, swimming those 40 laps. It was crazy. It was a lot. But I learned in a swimming facility that was open to the children, to the public. And it had a gym across the way, which I never went to. I was stayed in a pool area. But Sharp James wanted that. And there were pools all over Newark, because black kids couldn't swim for a long time in swimming pools that they would pour concrete in, because they didn't want our black bodies in there. This man was committed to making sure. So he had some corruption stuff, because power corrupts. But he also has you know, seeds, because that's where he's from. And we should have accountability at the same time as people who represent us actually being from the place.
Good afternoon, friends. It is my high honor to welcome our next speaker, a man whom, without all the success and progress American cities have made over the last 4 years, simply would not be possible. American mayors could ask for no better friend and partner than the 46th President of the United States, Joseph R. Biden. It's easy now. It's easy now, as cities are thriving, to forget just how tough a spot we were all in just 4 years ago. It was a real-life nightmare. The most disruptive global event in our lifetimes had decimated our revenues, erased millions of jobs overnight, and taken far too many lives. American mayors had a partner. Working hand in hand, President Biden led the most productive 4 years for American cities in our history. He delivered the American Rescue Plan that brought us back from the brink. He then helped us catapult ahead with the bipartisan infrastructure law. He made history's greatest investment in the fight against climate change in the Inflation Reduction Act. And among many other achievements, he set in motion a great renaissance of American manufacturing with the CHIPS and Science Act. It is a record that will not only stand the test of time, but had profound, tangible benefits for the people we serve and the cities we love. Today, our cities are vibrant and brimming with optimism. And for that, we cannot thank you enough for your devoted leadership. Indeed, thank you is not enough. That's why today I'm proud to announce that we are taking the very rare step of presenting to President Joe Biden the United States Conference of Mayors Award for Distinguished Public Service. This is our highest honor, and there's no more fitting recipient than President Biden. Mr. President, your legacy of achievement and support for the working people of this country will forever be celebrated. On behalf of America's mayors, we honor you and thank you for your service and for your friendship. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, Joseph R. Biden.
Gittler, thank you very much from Columbus, Ohio, for your leadership of this conference. Please have a seat if you have one. Thank you, Tom Cochran, for your remarkable stewardship of the U.S. Conference of Mayors for decades. I want to give a special thanks to his wife, Clarita, who I just met. She's running around here, feeling after she broke her hip. You doing well? Anyway, Tom, you and I have something in common. We both married way above our station. To my hometown mayor, John Carney. John, where are you? Out there? Wilmington, Delaware. Thank you, John. This guy's a true public servant. He just finished 8 years as a great governor and then decided to run for mayor. A special thanks to another great friend, the mayor of my second home, Scranton, Pennsylvania, Paige Cignotti. Paige. It's an honor to receive this award. As I measure the significance of the award based on the character and the consequences of the organization bestowing the award. The U.S. Conference of Mayors is an organization of character and consequence. And thanks to all of you for your partnership and the progress we made together these 4 years. I must say, a big reason we got so much done is because all former mayors have served in my administration. Steve Benjamin, Pete Buttigieg, Marsha Fudge, Keisha Lance Bottom, Mitch Landrieu, Tom Vilsack, Marty Walsh. And thanks to Tom Perez, a guy like me who has been my point person for all of this, but he's a county guy. That's tougher, man. I don't know, man. This is one of the last events that I'll be doing as president. And the reason I chose to be here is because of the first thing that I did as president was to speak to this conference. You know, as many of you know, maybe you weren't here then, but many of you know, I started my career as a local councilman. I only ran for the Senate because it was too damn hard being a local councilman. You know, people know where you live. They think you can solve every problem. They think you got more money than you do and more power than you do. You're in the front lines answering key questions of their lives. Is my neighborhood safe? My kid going to have the good fortune to be here in his hometown? Will there be jobs here? So many other questions. It matters. What you do matters, matters, matters. When we first met 4 years ago, the pandemic was raging, and our economy was reeling. 4 years later, our nation and our cities have emerged stronger than we were when we entered the crisis. I come here today for a couple reasons. First, my administration released a report summarizing the impact of our work together to invest in America. It all started with the American Rescue Plan, one of the most significant recovery packages in our history, to get us out of the immediate crisis of the pandemic and save thousands of lives. One of the most important decisions I made was to send money directly to you. Directly to you. I've been a local official. Governors are good guys and women, but when you send it to the state legislature, they divide it up before it gets to you. It goes directly to you when I do it. So you control the outcome. Then we passed the Invest in America Act. That's launching a new era of American possibilities. One of the greatest modernization of infrastructure in our history, we passed. New roads, bridges, clean water, affordable high-speed internet for every American. Now, each of you, because there's so many examples of the projects in your community, there's thousands of them. We also made the biggest investment in fighting climate change ever in the history of the world, not just America, because of you. And I think one thing we've all changed together, when I use the word here climate, I think jobs. I think jobs when I hear climate. We're creating hundreds of thousands of good-paying, clean energy jobs. We've proven you don't have to choose between protecting the environment and growing the economy. You're doing both. We have to keep pushing forward, push forward faster. There's no time to waste. I'm with you and your governors to make the devastating hurricanes and floods and tornadoes and wildfires, like the catastrophic fires and wildfires in California. Together, we push Congress for extra disaster relief funding, to rebuild homes and businesses across the Carolinas, to cover the full cost of replacing the collapsed Key Bridge in Baltimore, and so much more. At the same time, we work with you to upgrade the power grids, plant millions of trees, build resilient communities to withstand extreme weather. Not only build, but to build back better than before. Build back better. We also made the most significant investment in science and innovation. America invented the semiconductor. Now we're bringing those chip factories back home to America where they belong. I've stood with you in Columbus, Syracuse, Phoenix, and many more fields of dreams. where these fabs, these massive new factories the size of several football fields, are being built. And I speak, as I speak, you're going to create at least 125,000 good-paying jobs. And the jobs in these fabs are going to pay over $100,000 a year, and you don't need a college degree. You don't have to move from your hometown. You can stay where you are. If I could pause a minute, you know what's going to happen as well? When you build these factories, they're going to have to build more barbershops, beauty salons. I'm not joking. They're going to build grocery stores. They're going to build drug stores. It grows communities in a big way. We will soon be the only economy in the world to have all five of the top chip companies operating in America, creating thousands of jobs. And for the first time in decades, these new factories are producing the most advanced chips right here in America. These aren't just fabs, these investments are creating opportunities for entire communities, for small business, creating even more jobs, and so much more. I've kept my commitment to be president for all of America, whether you voted for me or not. In fact, studies show my programs have delivered more for red states than blue states. The results are clear. 16.6 million new jobs, the lowest average unemployment rate for 50 years, a record 21 million new applications to start new businesses. And every one of those applications is an act of hope in your communities. Wages are up. Inflation is down. And we passed the most significant gun safety law in 30 years. We're slashing overdose deaths by 26% last year. You did it faster than ever, and seizing record amounts of fentanyl, making life-saving Narcan available over the counter. Violent crime is now at a 50-year low. Because of you. The bottom line, you've produced an incredible 4 years. So much we got done together. It'll take time to see and feel, though. But the seeds have been planted. Will grow and they'll bloom for decades to come, and none of it could have happened without all of you. And that's not hyperbole, none of it. You know, we're not finished yet. Earlier today, I announced three major priorities that mark important progress in our country. First, after fighting Big Pharma for decades as a senator and then vice president as president, we finally beat Big Pharma. Instead of paying $400 a month for insulin, seniors now pay $35 a month. But that wasn't the only thing that happened when we passed the bill. Starting this month, the total prescription drug cost for seniors is capped at $2,000, no matter how expensive their drugs are. Even expensive cancer drugs that cost $10,000, $12,000, $14,000, they're not going to have to pay more than $2,000 a year. And finally, we gave Medicare the power to negotiate lower drug prices like the VA has been able to do for veterans all along. These negotiations are being implemented in phases. The first phase negotiated lower prices for the 10 most expensive drugs for seniors, covering drugs for blood costs and so much more. And just this morning, I announced the next phase, the next 15 drugs subject to negotiations. Drugs that will treat cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and so much more, including Ozempic. Hard to say. But it really is an incredible drug. These reforms just don't save seniors money. They save the American taxpayer $160 billion. The taxpayer over the next decade. Why? That $160 billion in Medicare is saving for negotiating lower drug prices in Big Pharma doesn't have to be paid out by the government. $160 billion. Second, just over 100 years ago, a pioneering group of women proposed the Equal Rights Amendment to enshrine the principles of gender equality in our Constitution. Throughout my career, I've been clear, no one should be discriminated against based on their sex. And in order for the amendment to be ratified, it requires three-fourths of the states to ratify it. That benchmark was passed when Virginia ratified the ERA a few years ago. Today, I affirm the Equal Rights Amendment to have cleared all the necessary hurdles to be added to the U.S. Constitution now. The Equal Rights Amendment is the law of the land now. It's the 28th Amendment to the Constitution now. I consulted dozens of constitutional scholars to make sure there was all within the power to do this. And the fact is, we did. And third, our cities are places for a second chance. Earlier today, I commuted the sentence of nearly 2,500 convicted nonviolent drug offenders. These individuals are serving a disproportionately long and harsh sentence compared to the sentence they would receive had they committed the crime today. After spending too long behind bars, these individuals will soon be reunited with their families and communities. With this action, I make no apology. I've issued more individual pardon and commutation than any president in U.S. history. There is more work to do, but when we allow our justice system to be placed, a place of both accountability and mercy, it strengthens our cities and our nation as well, in my view. Let me close with this. Serving as your president has been the honor of my life. When my term in office is ending, the work continues. Your work continues. My farewell address 2 days ago, I talked how each of us must be guardians of democracy to restore the strength of our institutions and democracy. The presidency, the Congress, the courts all have minimum requirements under the law to deal with those safeguards, and a free and independent press, and yes, local governments. The strength of our institution depends on the character of leaders like you. In our time together, I'm forever thankful to have seen the strength, your strength and your character. And we need it now more than ever. The magic of America has been everyone has a fair shot. Everyone deserves is determined to be able to be treated with dignity. No guarantee, just a fair shot. I've always believed America can be defined in one word. I remember being in the Tibetan Plateau with Xi Jinping. I've met with him for over 90 hours alone. Traveled 17,000 miles with him. Very significant differences. He looked at me and he said, "Can you define America for me?" And I said in one word, possibilities. We're the only nation in the world. Only nation in the world. Has come out of every crisis we've ever gone in stronger than we went in. Only one. Look at the history. We're the only nation in the world that believes when we act together, there's not a damn thing we can't do. Only in America, baby, anything is possible. You just have to remember who we are. We're the United States of America. Nothing is beyond our capacity when we do it together and act together. God bless you all. Keep working together. We need you. We need you. We need you. We need you. And may God protect our troops. Thank you so very much.
And finally, something from our friends at Native Land Podcasting.
Confirmation, confirmation, confirmation. We are a couple of days out from the shifting of administrations. And when a new president and vice president come in, yes, a whole new cabinet, a whole new